I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
The Telegraph. The Telegraph. Podcasts.
So today, I'm very lucky to have here in our studio the lovely Jade and her mother Claire. Jade, you are part of a BBC Two documentary that goes out this week called Girls on the Edge, which is about young girls who have been sectioned under the Mental Health Act and the effect that has on their families. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to talk a bit about that. It's really great to have you here. I really appreciate you coming in and chatting to us. It's a brave thing to do, and we need more people like you to kind of take the plunge and talk honestly about what is a reality of life and something that we all need to kind of accept and face up to. Jade, how old are you? Can I just start with?
I'm 18.
You're 18. Okay. Yeah. We start each podcast with the same question, which is, how are you right now? Like, really? Because, you know, we ask, how are you? A million times a day, we say, how are you?
Yeah.
We go, yeah, fine. When actually, sometimes deep down inside, they're completely crying to get out. And, you know, sometimes they're brilliant by the same token, and we don't ever talk about it. So, how are you right now, Jade?
I'm struggling a little bit.
You're struggling?
At the minute. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
I don't mind.
So why don't we talk about your story and what it is you struggle with?
So I struggle, well, the diagnosis that I struggle with is schizotypal personality disorder.
Okay.
With depressive episode and OCD as well.
Okay.
It's kind of more on the paranoid thoughts kind of thing. I don't really know how to explain it.
Well, tell me, when did you first experience it? Or is it just something that you've always remembered?
It's something which has been with me for a long time. I don't remember not experiencing these things, but this diagnosis was only brought to life to me after I was in hospital for 9 months.
Okay.
Because they were flipping back between psychotic depression and personality disorder and just depressive episodes and then OCD as well. But then one psychiatrist pulled out this information sheet and I never kind of related so much to what was said, but it's really hard for me to kind of comprehend that that's actually what it is, because whenever I say about it to anyone, everyone goes, what? That's kind of like me, because I don't really know how to explain it myself. It's not
so
really
what was like on the information sheet that you identified with so much?
So it's things like, again, paranoid thoughts, avoiding people, isolating. Some of the things that people with this disorder struggle with is an eccentric sense of style.
Okay.
Which I don't normally struggle with, but when I'm more unwell, I do kind of don't really care what I really wear at all. I can wear like blue shoes and a bright green top and I'll be absolutely fine.
Claire, your mum is nodding her head. I mean, it might be good to hear from you as a parent. When did you notice that perhaps Jade was unwell?
It took quite a while, actually. She was actually very quite young. She kind of hid herself away from everybody else, and we just thought maybe she was just, she was introvert. And because her twin sister, Megan, she is not. She's very extrovert. So we just thought maybe there's two completely different personalities and didn't think anything else at all. And then she got a little bit older, say about 12, 13, and things became more apparent. She could keep her temper low and she'd be very, very patient, and suddenly she would just snap for absolutely no reason, and it was almost as if she became somebody completely different. And then her sense of style went out the window. She's always had some form of style, but it was a case of one day she would literally wear completely different colour clothing. We're talking from, we could be wearing different colour socks, different colour tops, different colour. We're talking a walking rainbow. And we did used to make a joke about it. And it wasn't till she got to about 16 that we realised that things were not right.
So it's quite interesting because you hear this quite a lot, and I know certainly my parents struggled with it when I was a teenager, and I think a lot of parents struggle with it, is to recognise what is just someone being an adolescent and hormonal, and what is actually a genuine illness that really needs to be taken seriously. Was that something you had problems with?
It was trying to work out if there was a problem or whether I was just making a thing out of it, or was she just being a teenager? She was trying to find an individual style. It was all these things that go over in your head. Is it me? Am I just picking out that she's probably not like Megan, trying to compare her too much to her sister? Is she like her friends? Has she got many friends? It was very difficult, very difficult. And you don't want to stamp a particular label on her and just say, yeah, okay, she's very extrovert, she's very eclectic. Yeah. That's how I used to say it. She's very introvert, actually.
So what happened? Did you sort of sink into depression?
I think that's kind of where it started. So I've kind of always had a lot of different friendship groups anyway. And it became very apparent when I was about 13, 14, that I was just flipping back in between people. And I'd never really had any really close friends. And I only realised this very recently, that it was because I would get so worried and paranoid about the fact that my friendship group were just going to leave me and that they didn't like me and stuff like that. And first of all, I thought, you know what, that's normal. But then it became every single group, and I was switching groups every year just because I was so worried that they were going to leave me. And so I pushed them away, and it became worse because the paranoid thoughts became quite unsettling in terms of thinking that people were following me. I remember there was one incident where I was a mentor to a year seven, and I was given this girl because they thought I would work well with her, and I ended up thinking that she was stalking me and stuff like that. It's because she was very inquisitive. I remember thinking, do you know what, I can't leave the house, I can't go to school. I'd get so worried about seeing her in the corridor just in case she would approach me, and that's when I thought, you know what, this isn't right.
Yeah, so kind of an inability to leave the house, you became sort of a housebound.
Yeah, kind of. I was just so worried that whenever I turned a corner she'd be there, and so it kind of grew on that, and it linked in because my obsessional thoughts got worse. And a friend who I walked to school with, she started noticing that I was becoming very anxious on my way walking to school, because I have to walk on a certain side and not walk over certain things and walk over certain things, and then I'd be doing these mental calculations in my mind, and I'd always be so set on what I was doing. And I remember one day we had, you know, the green boxes, I always walked the left side around it. And one day, she kind of stopped me from walking around it. And it was all just a joke. And then I remember getting home from school and being in tears because I couldn't... I linked everything bad that happened that day just because...
Because of walking the wrong way around the green box.
Yeah.
That really resonates with me. I have quite serious obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah.
And it's that thing of thinking... And also being having to do the ritual. Otherwise, something terrible is going to happen.
Yeah.
And not being able to kind of... relax until you've done it, but then of course as soon as you've done it, something else comes up.
Yeah,
something else fills that hole.
Yeah,
also there's that thing, did I do it right? Maybe I didn't do it right. I better go around it again and do it again. Isn't there?
Yeah.
So I mean, you were sectioned.
Yes, I was. Yeah.
So can you talk a bit about what happened, how old you were, the lead up to that, and Claire, if you want to come in at any point.
So I was sinking deep into depression, not really thinking anything of it, and my self-harm became a lot worse.
Claire, you sound like you...
Yeah, it was a case of nearly once a week, I'd say, we were going to A&E.
Because of Jade self-harm. Had to harmed herself.
Yeah. For Jade, it became, probably remember, a matter of fact, it was, oh, look at what I've done. But it wasn't in a bad way.
No, it was kind of more, it wasn't a relief. I went into a different place, and I think it was sort of like dissociation. So I kind of disassociated and tried to bring myself away from what happened because I didn't want to be there in that moment. I always remember making jokes mm-hmm. about the situation at the time. I remember self-harming and my mum rinsing the towel out in the bath and me joking that it was like someone got murdered and it was like a bloodbath. And at the time I thought it was absolutely hilarious, and I remember my mum being so on edge about the situation, like snapping back.
But yeah, what was it, the one that you did, and you said to me, oh look, I've got tiger stripes where she cut herself.
And I don't remember this.
I mean, that must be one
I've
of
got
the
it very, very
things.
Clear in my mind how it happened and when it happened, and Jade saying what she said. I know what she said was not, there was no intent, no malice to it. For her, it was just what she had to do because she couldn't cope. It was almost a cry for help.
Yeah. And so that was getting worse. And so originally I went into hospital for learning how to control my self-harm behaviours in a controlled environment.
What was that like? What was the hospital? Can you sort of describe a bit to us about what the...
I don't think a lot of people kind of know what the setting's actually like. And most people assume it's like an asylum, but
it's really interesting to hear, to hear the reality.
So I was in a waiting room for ages, for hours, waiting for the on-call doctor to assess me to make sure that I was able to go into the ward, write down information. And when I got onto the ward, it was very... It wasn't sterile. You could see that it was looked at and risk assessed and stuff like that, but there were still certain things out because this was an open ward, and all the patients were really lovely, they're all really welcoming. But the one thing that I noticed was that there was, I think there were blue chairs, like literally nailed down into the ground. And I remember thinking, gosh, those are going to be so uncomfortable. But just walking in, it was just people just like me. It was, at the time, it was all girls. And so it was just people all like me, just all struggling with different things. And it was weird being in that environment because I'd never been with a lot of people who were really struggling at the same time, because normally it was only I knew one other person, but we weren't really in the same situation. It's kind of, you're just living with a load of people, and the bedrooms are so different. I mean, you couldn't have clothes that needed to be hung up in the wardrobe because you couldn't hang up anything in the wardrobe.
In case it was a suicide risk, presumably. Yeah.
I guess being in hospital made it worse in that respect because you pick up behaviours in hospital that you knew of, but you didn't really know how it happened at the time. And I can see why people think that, and it is a bad thing, it is, but the staff make it so safe most of the time.
So how long were you in hospital for?
In total, about 18 months.
Okay.
So but I was meant to be in for 2 months.
Yeah.
And then, Claire, do you want to take on the story and what happened?
What, while she was in hospital?
Yeah, so how did you come to be...
It was really difficult. I've got to be really honest, and Jade will know that. The first day that I left her, she was very relaxed, but she knew that they were going to do the best thing that they could for her. But for me, it was extremely difficult because it was me. I couldn't understand how we had got to the position we were in where Jade was in hospital. Why was she here? What am I doing bringing my daughter here? More to the point, what am I doing leaving my daughter here? Mm. And are they going to do the best for her? And asking myself all these stupid, long-winded questions and going over and over in my head, have I done the right thing? Should she be here? Well, yes, she should.
So you were there for 2 months and you were then... sectioned?
Yes, I was, yeah. My behaviour escalated to a point where I had a really serious incident, one which could have ended really badly.
Are you allowed to talk about what that involved?
Yeah. So I tied a ligature, and it was... the ligature-proof area wasn't ligature-proof.
Right.
And nurses came in and found me, basically, because I only did it a couple of seconds earlier, but seeing the panic on their faces, I still remember it now. I still remember the panic on their faces. I remember them getting me down, and from then on I was put on, so you have one-to-ones, and I was on arm's length, so there was arm's length and eyesight, so eyesight was just watching them, and then arm's length was literally arm's length away.
So you were always being watched by someone?
Yes, when I was on one-to-one, yes, I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. And because I was talking to my psychologist and he was certain that I was going to put on section three, but at the time I didn't have a diagnosis, and they can't detain you without a formal diagnosis or an informal diagnosis which they can put on you. And so I was put on section two and transferred to another hospital. It's a 28-day period where they assess you. And in that time, if they feel like you're ready to become informal again, if you have capacity, you can get taken off your section then. But if they decide that you don't have capacity and you're too much of a risk, you have another Mental Health Act assessment and get put on section three.
Which is
I think it's a section for, it's mainly for treatment. It's a 6-month period time.
So you were sectioned. How old were you when you were sectioned, Jade?
16.
Yeah. Okay. Can you talk through, Claire, as often these things happen, and when they're happening to the actual person, it's a sort of, as you say, kind of disassociated process. But can you talk through what it was like for you as a parent?
Difficult. That is one way to describe it, I guess. Knowing that your daughter has been put onto section three, that you can argue that she shouldn't be and you've got to have reasonable doubt, but at the end of the day, when you know that your child is very sick and she definitely needs the section three, I don't think they'll go out of their way to put someone on section three if they don't need to.
So it's that thing of, in our language, so often we use the word "you sectioned." I feel it's really important to know what the reality of that is, which is obviously what this documentary is presenting, which is brilliant. You're stuck in that strange place where obviously it's alarming, but you know it's probably the best place for your child. What are the rules on sectioning children?
If you're not willing to stay and have treatment in that hospital, then that's the main reason why most people get sectioned, because they see that in the community you're a harm to yourself or others.
Or others.
And if you're not willing to stay in the hospital,
they have to force you to stay.
They have to force you to stay.
What's it like hearing that your child is a danger to themselves or others?
Heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking. Because you're trying to tell yourself that everything's fine, that this is just a blip, and deep down inside you know it's not, and then they throw the final lead at you and say, "I'm sorry, but Jade has been sectioned under the Mental Health Act." I said, "What section?" And they said section three. I'd already been doing a little bit of homework on it just to make sure I did know.
This was when I was at the other hospital.
Yes, and Jade got moved from the first hospital because as soon as they sectioned her, it was a case of it was too much for that hospital to deal with. So they had to transfer her to a hospital that could cope.
This is remarkable to me, that you have a seriously ill child being sort of passed from hospital to hospital because
miles away as well.
Okay, so I mean, I think this argument is made quite a lot with mental health, that you wouldn't send a stroke patient or someone who'd had a severe heart attack hundreds of miles away from their family, and yet the same parity does not exist with people with mental health issues. So you live in Northampton.
Yeah.
So where did you end up in hospital, Jade?
I ended up in Woking.
Okay, so that's a fair old whack. You have other children, and tell me what the hospital was like. Because as we said earlier, there's this notion of, and a lot of hospitals still, they were asylums.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So the names may have changed, but the infrastructure is still kind of Dickensian, basically. Yeah. So talk about your experiences.
Oh, gosh. I remember that first day at the new hospital so clearly. So I was transferred in a secure ambulance.
What's the secure ambulance like?
So luckily I was settled at the time, and so I got to sit in the seat at the back.
Yeah, it wouldn't be normally.
If you were unsettled or they felt like you might be able to abscond, so run away, it's almost like a cell at the back.
Mm-hmm.
With bars and plastic on it and stuff like that.
So you were, they were obviously worried about you harming yourself. Can you explain, were you kind of fighting against people? There can be a lot of fear in these situations. Yeah. How were you in your person, so to speak?
I was so consumed in my own head, and all I could think about was harming myself. I wasn't safe enough to be on my own. They thought, and I knew that if I was on my own, I would try to kill myself. That was the reason why I was on the one-to-one. Yeah, I was so consumed in myself that I didn't... Obviously, I cared about my family, but that wasn't in my mind. I made up all of these things in my head so that it would make sense to me as to why it would be okay for me to go. So I would say, oh, but my mum has other children, my friends have other people. My future wasn't really in anything anyway because I had this plan for ages, and GCSEs were irrelevant at that point because I was in hospital. And so I would kind of make up excuses to justify to myself as to why it would be okay to do it, because it got to that point where I had no rationale as to why I shouldn't do it. Every second of the day I was thinking about the checks, so the different timings about when people were going to check on me so that I could figure out when to do it, how long it would take, what to use, when they were changing over on one-to-one, if they were paying attention, how I could get off one-to-one so I could do it.
So all of your energy was devoted basically to working out how you could kill yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're transferred in a safe ambulance.
Yes.
You were just saying how you can still remember that day so clearly.
Yeah. I remember sitting, and I hated it at the time. I sat on the right-hand side, and I hate being on the right. At the time, I was very much within my obsessional thoughts, and I had to be on the left, but they put me on the right. I had two other staff members with me, and one was someone from the NHS ambulance service, and another one was a staff member. I remember them playing the radio, but the radio, the speaker didn't come out, so it was the people at the front, sitting in the van and being so worried at the time. And it was weird because I did product design at school, and so I had all my coursework, and they literally just chucked it in the van with my guitar as well, and that got messed up, and I was so worried, even though I was really not concerned about my GCSEs or anything. In that moment I was thinking, oh gosh, all my stuff is going to get wrecked. And I remember arriving at the place, honestly it was absolutely horrific, because when you come up, when they have new admissions, they go in the van and then they close the gate behind you, and the male wards were on the right hand side, and they always knew when people were coming in, they would shout out and they were allowed to smoke and stuff like that. And then there was the adolescents on the left hand side, it was their courtyard, and it was such a different environment because this was a PQ. Psychiatric.
So everyone had been sectioned?
Most people had been sectioned, yeah. Everyone was there because they were severely unwell. Yeah.
You clearly, this is really hard for you to talk about.
Yeah, sorry, I've got a dry throat.
Yeah, well, take some water. You know, don't rush yourself. It's honestly fine. I mean, to me, it seems incredible that, you know, a young girl is taken to, there is not another option.
No.
So you were taken into this, what does sound like a sort of our perception of an asylum.
Yes.
The luckily, sort of rattling on the bars and the...
Luckily, the staff members, the HCAs at the time, they were so lovely. And I think that's what differentiates it from being an asylum, is that the staff members and the people there are so lovely. Mm-hmm. I remember a staff member at the time, he had tattoos. And I remember he had a semicolon. I remember seeing that he had a semicolon.
Which is the sign...
Mental health issue. Or you're in support of someone with mental health issues. Yeah. And seeing that, it kind of relaxed me a little bit. But being on the ward was very different because it was a completely different environment. People were really, really unwell. I remember someone pacing up and down the corridor, and I was put into a room and all the other patients were looking in. And I remember when I had got assessed and my background story medication was wrote down, the other patients came in and said hello to me, and they were very unwell, but they were so welcoming. And that made such a difference in how I was at the time, because I internalise a lot of feelings. And so even if I was feeling really anxious, it would kind of be within myself. Mm-hmm. And it would be more the thought processes than outwardly showing how anxious I was about going onto the ward. Yeah.
I can tell it's really hard for you, and I just want to like get up and give you a big cuddle and say it's okay. So how can you talk through how you came to be involved in this documentary?
Yep. So I was part of a feedback group for St Andrews in Fitzroy called Fitzroy Forum, which was decided whilst we were still there. I remember coming in with the ward manager, and there being no other seats, and Holly, the director, she was sat on the end and she was looking really nervous. And I remember sitting next to her and thinking, I don't recognise this woman.
Is she on the ward? Is she a new patient?
You know, I didn't know. I knew she was a visitor because she had her visitor's lanyard on. And when she was speaking, she was so nervous to speak to the other patients because she thought she would get such a bad reception from it. And she started speaking about it, and all the other patients in there were asking about when it would be on, who it'd be for, and she didn't really have the answers at the time, but she just told us the basics of it. And I remember thinking that would be a good way to get out some awareness of what's actually going on, but no one had a clear idea of what exactly the documentary would be. We didn't know if it was going to be kind of a community type thing, or whether it's going to be individual stories, or whether it was going to focus on the system and stuff like that. But it was just kind of going with it, and I wanted to be involved with it because I thought this is my way to make a difference and to actually get out there what's actually happening, and for awareness for people to realise that, because there's so much stigma around mental health, but also around being hospitalised for mental health purposes. And everyone who I've been in hospital with has had bad experiences with people's perceptions of what mental health hospitals are like. Being in A&E is a bad one, actually.
So being in a general accident and emergency for a mental health issue, what is that like?
Oh, it's
You're
awful.
Shaking your head, Claire.
No, I have to say this. Seriously, I know that the A&E teams do as much as they possibly can, but what I am absolutely outstanding at is the fact that none of them seem to have any idea about mental health at all, about self-harm. The amount of times I've taken Jade in, and one in particular, and I took her in there, and the nurse looked straight at Jade and said, "Now, what have you done to yourself? You really shouldn't do that, you know." And I said,
"Oh, well, if it was that easy."
She's a mental health patient, seriously, she's self-harm. She said, "Well," she looked straight at me, "and if you're her mum," she said, "why are you allowing her to do that?" I thought, excuse me. It was like this every time. I appreciate they're really pushed and it's not their fault, but there is no training whatsoever for when mental health patients come in.
So they'll treat the actual injury, but they won't treat the reason behind it.
In the meantime, they'll try to get behind it and find out, why did you do what you did?
Yeah.
Well, if I knew that, I would have done it, would I?
But also that attitude of, you know, you shouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
Well, I wish you'd been in my house 3 hours ago, as if everything was that simple.
Yeah. And I know every hospital has a mental health liaison team, but they're so stretched at the time, it's kind of no one's really on your side apart from the people who are with you if you're going. I remember being in hospital and having to go back to the general for dressings, and it being dressed because I interrupted the healing process of one of the self-harm wounds. And I remember going with a nurse at the time. I was in paediatrics, in the paediatrics A&E, and the doctor came straight in. He looked like he had the worst day, and I get it, working there would be a struggle, but it was how he treated me was absolutely awful. He said, "Why couldn't you do this at the hospital you were at?" He didn't know that the place we're at is a psychiatric hospital. "Why don't you have those resources? Why do you have to come in here?" And the nurse looked him straight in the eye and said, "We're a psychiatric hospital, we do not have these resources." And he told me, "Why don't you just cut your teddy bear instead?" Which, because that would be safer. And I was thinking, oh, how arrogant are you? Like, surely, I wasn't even asking to have some sort of conversation where they would understand. I would rather just not be spoken to.
You'd rather just be treated.
Rather be treated and get out. I didn't want to be there. That was the last place I wanted to be.
It seems to me that if you had a child with a severe physical illness, the situation would be very different. And it seems to me that currently the system is such that if I brought my daughter into hospital and said she's got a broken arm, and if they turned around to me and said, "All right, well, we can maybe treat her in sort of 6 months' time or something," or, "Well, why did you break your arm? That was stupid." Do you know what I mean?
Why didn't you watch her?
Why were you not watching her out the back of your head? There would be, there would be absolute outrage. And yet that kind of stuff is happening every day in this country because of a lack of funding and because hospitals are so stretched. Now, obviously, there are bigger reasons, political reasons, that we don't want to get into. What I want to do is sort of just, and what clearly this BBC documentary seeks to do, is just tell the story as it is and raise awareness of it. Also, we don't want to scare young people off seeking help.
Oh, no,
obviously.
Not, no.
You were in the hospital for 18 months in total. Yep. What would be your message to people who have a perception of what being sectioned involves and what being in a psychiatric hospital involves?
Just don't judge it unless you know what's happening. I mean, there are a lot of things that places have done wrong, but it has no sort of effect in comparison to the good things that they have done right. They've saved people's lives. And I would just say to people that don't worry about the amount of time that you're there, even if you're there for a week or if you're there for years. Like, this point in your life is about you. This is the most important time in your recovery. You're not going to come out and be recovered. That's just the reality of it. You're not going to go in there
And get cured.
No, it's something which is going to be happening for a long time and you've got to work at it. But
every day, like as you would manage a chronic physical illness. Yeah. If you had diabetes, you would try and eat well, you would take your medicine.
And it's the same with mental health problems, especially mental health problems. You have to want to recover before it happens. And it sounds stupid saying that I didn't want to recover. I don't think a lot of people realise how difficult it is to recover. It's so much more easier just to relapse than to recover. But it got to a point where it was either I give up or I start trying. And it was one of the most difficult times of my life, actually picking myself back up again to the point where I was like, I'm going to do this time. The support of the nurses on the ward and the other patients was probably the main reason of why I'm actually here today. All of them collectively saved my life, and because it sounds really emotional, but the other patients, they become like family, and a lot of them are family.
Have you made friends?
I made friends for life. I mean, some of them I was with from August to September, so I was with for a year and a month, and they became family because you're living with them most of the time, and when people get leave, it's the most wonderful thing.
So when you get to see them be well enough to go.
Yes, you do. And it's emotional because it's kind of like you're saying goodbye to someone, but you're knowing that they're going on to better things. There was a girl that was in there. There was a few of them that was in there for the whole time that I was there. I remember saying goodbye to her when she left, and I got so emotional because we were so close, and she was kind of like the light to the ward. And whenever she was happy, the whole ward was happy. And whenever she got leave, she would kind of slide on her knees and she would go, yes, I got leave. And she'd go, I got overnight leave. But again, when she was really unwell, the whole ward felt for her. And it was just like having a really close family network, and the staff were great. They were
second
like having older sisters or older brothers, and they didn't treat you any differently. And there was obviously the doctors had to do their jobs, but they just understood. All the nurses understood, and going out on leave with them was hilarious.
So where would you tell me where you get to go on leave?
So it depends on your, for some people it was their levels or the stage in your escorted leave plan. So you could have, say, leave up to a road, say co-op, or you could go into town and so you'd have...
Because even going to a co-op could be quite a big thing.
We had grounds, really big grounds, and they were wonderful, actually. I loved going out with them.
They were just amazing. They really were. It was so great walking around there, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was so quiet.
A different town of your own. Place was huge.
But even going out to the cafe on site was such a big deal. And when everyone got to go and we had a drink, and because everyone there understood, even the people who worked there were either patients themselves and were doing work there to try and build up their time and build up so they could go on to be discharged. No one was judging anyone, and everyone would say hello, and no one would bat an eyelid if someone was shouting or...
behaved in what normal people, not normal, I'm using a lot of quotation marks here, but ways we may think are eccentric or unusual.
Yeah, and because the hospital had, I mean, there was mental health patients, learned disability, brain injury, I can't even think about the rest, but there's loads of different wards dedicated to certain things, but everyone had a mutual understanding that it was okay to be yourself. There were several times where me and my mum were out on the grounds, and you could see that a lot of them were very unwell, but they were on their own, and we'd always make conversation with them. And you'd think, you know what, literally just a few minutes away, if this was a cafe,
and this person walked out and did the same thing, people would react so differently. And do you know what? They're just human.
So this is such a lovely thing. What I love is that we can have these experiences and they can break us or they can make us.
Yeah.
And actually, that experience, although awful at times, has probably given you a completely invaluable view on the world.
Definitely.
And how to treat people with kindness and without judgment.
Yeah, I've never been one to judge anyone anyway, and if my sisters have ever looked at someone differently just because they're different than everyone else, or different than everyone else, I'm kind of like, no, don't look. They can't help it. Don't look. Because I was always kind of wary before of how I was around them. And now I like hearing their side of the story. Mm. I work down in a place called Workbridge, which is in the hospital grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity to do a placement down there as a service user, where I would work in an office environment and be with other service users as well, and we'd have mentors to make sure everyone was on track. A lot of the people down there struggled with learning disabilities, but that was one of the nicest experiences I've ever had in my life, was going in there, people being very wary of me, and by the time that I left, which was about 9 months later, being hugged and saying that I was their favourite person.
Aww. Or
it was the nicest thing. And because I do quite well academically, not to blow my head up here,
I think you should blow your own trumpet.
Yeah, this is quite sickening, really.
So you did well academically.
Yeah.
Go on then.
So I was in charge of the accounts from Workbridge, which was just the money coming in from the coffee shop, garden centre, and the canteen within the Workbridge area. So Workbridge does things, they make canvases for customers, there's a wood workshop which they sell to the community, and there's a garden centre, there's the office work which people come in and they have orders and they do mail shots and it goes out and everyone there feels like they're a part of the team.
And you were in charge of the accounts.
I was in charge of the accounts, and that led me to have the opportunity to be able to work in the finance department with the management of accounts, Claire, in Cliftonville House, which was where all admin people were. And even in there, people were so lovely, so understanding. And when I was at college, I was asked to go back and do my work placement there. I'm not at college anymore, but I am.
What are you doing now?
Currently, I'm looking to do a course at college for teaching, because I ideally like to become a primary teacher. I just want to give back to the teachers.
So what I'm really interested about, it was so nice hearing about your experiences, you know, at the kind of close-knit community that you had in the hospital. And I think it's really important to not dissuade people from getting help, obviously.
Yeah.
Because obviously when you get it, when you eventually do get it, it's worth holding on for, to actually get it.
Yeah.
But also, what I'm really interested in hearing from you, Jade, is any messages you have for other young girls or boys that may be in your situation who may be self-harming. They may not have the same thing as you or the same diagnosis as you. They may not even have a diagnosis.
Yeah.
But they are in a bad place. They're bleak. What would you say to someone who may be listening to this now in despair and not knowing what to do, or to a parent who might be listening and not knowing what to do with a child? What would your advice be?
I think the biggest thing, and it made such a difference to me when I actually started doing it, is communicate with people. Whether that's speaking to people, writing things down, using drawings, using cards, email, anything, communicating to people that you trust about things. If it's a parent, communicate with your child, or communicate with the person who is struggling. And to say teachers, to actually look out, there are definitely certain signs that you can see in students.
What would you say those signs were?
Isolation is a massive one for a lot of people. I guess not everyone can see it, and it doesn't happen for everyone, but I always say it, how I realised I was unwell was when a lot of times I'm very good at faking a smile, and I can do it and I can still see the smile in my eyes, I'm saying in commas, but when you don't see that, when I didn't see that anymore, I thought, you know what, no, I can't go on like this. So it's kind of looking out for things like, I sound like a manual for how to get help, but
you sound brilliant.
A change in behaviour, or I'm not really sure.
But that's all really useful stuff. But I think also looking at you now, and I didn't know you before, but I think that when you have a mental illness, there are always going to be times when that is the case. And as you said, it's a kind of constant battle. But there definitely looks to be a sort of sense of hope and in your face.
Yeah.
You mentioned the joy you felt for everyone on the days that they got to leave.
Yeah.
Talk me through the day that you got to leave and how that felt.
Oh, it was emotional. It was. It went from range of happiness to being really apprehensive as to what was to come. When you're in hospital, after any length of time, but after quite a long period of time away from people, it's really nerve-wracking.
Do you almost feel that that's become your sort of home, presumably?
Yeah, you
it's
do,
a safe
yeah.
place.
It did become my home. You know, there's family were there. Family were there because there's such a sense of community there. Coming out is very scary. I mean, it's great for the first couple of weeks. Honestly, it's like I have my phone, I have internet, I can go on social media.
That is the first thing that Jade said. I have my phone. I can use social media all the time.
But it wasn't just that. It was being able to communicate with people I haven't spoke to in a long time. And to be honest, there were people which I just cut straight out of my life. I thought, you know what, no, you're not, I'm not dealing with you anymore. There's some really, I'd say, poisonous people who are not good for your mental health at all, or for anyone's mental
fake
health.
Fake friends.
But you really found out who your friends were.
Oh yeah, definitely. And coming out, speaking to people, still communicating with people, and being able to speak to, I think, my sisters, especially Megan, my twin sister, was great because she didn't like coming into hospital because it was very hard on her and she didn't like the environment. And actually being able to communicate with her and seeing her was the best thing.
You have literally been through the most extreme example of what one can go through in terms of the psychiatric system in this country and you've come out the other side.
Yes, and you know what, I think the best thing that someone ever said to me was it's okay to not be okay. And I think it's about accepting that sometimes you're not gonna feel okay, but it is gonna get better. Don't judge someone by how they are. I mean, a lot of the times I seem okay, but I could be absolutely dying inside, and it could be the same. Just treat everyone with kindness. Just everyone with kindness. Just give everyone a chance. Everyone's got something going on that they're battling with, and some people it's just on another level, but you never know what someone is going through, so just treat everyone with kindness.
If you've been affected by anything we've talked about in our podcast today, a comprehensive list of mental health services is available on our website, which is www.telegraph.co.uk/madworld. If you want help right now, the following organisations offer free and confidential support over the phone. The Samaritans can be reached 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on 116 123. Or you can contact the mental health charity Mind for advice on a range of mental health issues. Their phone number is 0300 123 3393. That's 0300 123 3393. And they are accessible 9 a.m. to 5 p.m, Monday to Friday, excluding bank holidays. Finally, there's Young Minds, who provide support if you're a parent or a carer worried about a child's welfare. They're on 0808 802 5544. That's 0808 802 5544. And remember this, you are not alone.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.